Welcome to the third episode of Otaku no Radio. I'm Anna Gamers, Chief Southern Correspondent Jared, and with me, as always, is the Simon to my Garfunkel, Anna Gamers Chief Poetry and Booze Correspondent, Inc.
Big damn robots.
Big damn robots. So today, we are going to form a blazing sword of analysis and in-depth discussion as we look at Voltron Legendary Defender from DreamWorks Animation and Beast King Go Lion from Toei. But first, before we do that, RightStuffAnime.com has their annual holiday sale going on right now, and we wanted to talk about what we thought were some of the more worthwhile bargains, since when this show actually comes out, it will still be relevant. We're only a few days into the sale at this point, and more is going to be added daily. But here's what we've found so far, and definitely check out the link in the program notes for any ongoing and up-to-date recommendations we find in the meantime.
There's a lot of great stuff, and we're on the spreadsheet. We try to give you reasons why we're personally recommending it. So if you trust our opinions, then you stand a fairly good shot, even if you don't know the series.
Yeah. I mean, it's some really good stuff, and it's going to just... I can't imagine what else is going to come up. I'm kind of excited to see what other big deals come up. Hopefully some ones with some big damn robots.
Big damn robots. So our show today involves Voltron Legendary Defender, which came out or was presented via Netflix and in its entirety, and sort of spawned this whole nostalgia trip for a whole bunch of us who grow up watching it on TV. I remember... early Christmas, long, long ago, where I got a huge package underneath the tree, and it was this box with five lions that formed into this huge, big damn robot. And my dad got it for me, I think, thinking it was a Transformer, but also not recognizing the fact that I actually watched that on TV while it was in syndication. And my love for that show is what made me watch Voltron Legendary Defender.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much the same thing for me, right? Voltron, Defender of the Universe, OG Voltron, I guess. I watched that in syndication as a, elementary school age kid, and it was one of my first early exposures to what I didn't know was anime, but I know it looked really different from some of the other shows I was watching, like G.I. Joe or... He-Man or something like that. And I'd always liked robots as a kid. So seeing these robots that could combine into a big robot was kind of a revelation for my 6 or 7 year old brain. And it just was really stylized too. I just remember always liking the style of the Voltron robot. It's so distinctive. And, as they came out with toys for it, I got it wasn't really big. It was like action figure size, but you could buy each of the lions and put them all together, and they formed Voltron. And it actually kind of held together pretty well as a toy, which was amazing.
Yeah, I remember them being sturdy.
Yeah, they were hefty. And then my stepbrother got this, like, remote control Voltron thing that was like, that would like move around. It didn't combine or anything. It was just like a statue with wheels, basically, and it would move around. It had the sword and everything. I thought that was really cool. Like, it just had some really cool toys, and they were so distinctive. It's always been a show for me that I've had a soft spot for it in my heart, I guess. And when they announced Voltron Legendary Defender, I was like, oh, okay, why not? It's on Netflix. I pay for Netflix. I can watch this. And I watched it, and I had that nostalgia trip, like Ink mentioned. And in the spirit of that nostalgia trip, I decided not to look directly into the void of our childhood and watch old Voltron Defender of the Universe again.
Because that is a dark, dark place.
Yeah, just... PSA from Otaku No Radio: don't do that. Don't watch the old Voltron. Just don't. If you're gonna watch something, go and watch Beast King Go Lion, because it's almost like revisiting your childhood, but like some mirror universe version of your childhood.
That's because I actually went back and I watched, because I honestly, like, it's a nostalgia trip, but I had forgotten basically everything about Voltron, aside from the fact that it was, you know, five lions that made up a huge big damn robot and yes. had a sword that took down, like, Monster of the Week. And that's all I remembered. I remembered how they looked and the pilots, but that was it. And when I watched Beast King Go Lion, it was actually a really good series. And then I went back to watch the original Voltron, Defender of the Universe, and I was looking at it like, oh my god, how did I like such crap?
Pretty much, man. Pretty much.
We'll get into that a little later. We'll start with because we watched this a bit differently just to see if we'd have any different takes on this. I watched I marathoned basically both series in sequence, Beast King Go Lion, then Legendary Defender. And Jared, how did you watch it?
So what I did is I watched an episode of Legendary Defender, and then I watched an episode of Beast King and or Beast King Go Lion, and just kind of alternated. And for that first, the with Legendary Defender, they have kind of like an hour long premiere. So to sort of balance that out, I watched like two of Go Lion, like episode one and two together, which was good, you know, because they were still setting up things between those two episodes. So it's kind of oddly parallel in a lot of ways. Watching them in parallel like that helped me see the passion that the Legendary Defender folks had for the source material, because you could see design elements in the different characters and things like the attitude of the characters, their personalities, design details in the robots themselves, even though they look quite different. In spirit, a lot of the same details are still there. And so for me, that was a really neat way to engage it and see that a little bit more clearly than I had the first time I watched Legendary Defender. Because I had actually seen Legendary Defender already and watched the whole thing. So I thought that was a neat way to sort of see the design influences, honestly.
Whereas I, by marathoning it, I sort of sank into the story a little more and saw the differences in focus between the two. And it's a lot more tellings of the times they were in which they were created. So to see that influence on both the shows was largely helpful in how I critiqued both. There's differences in not only agency given to certain characters, but also sort of this obsession, respective obsessions with technology and mysticism, which you would think the older series would be more, you know, obsessed with the mystic and the newer series would be more obsessed with the technological, but it's actually reversed, and that threw me. And that combined with how the new series didn't actually so much go off of the original, but the edited version of the original. I saw the love there for, you know, our nostalgia, but I saw it brought to a better platform, more serious storytelling, and less hokey attitudes towards the content.
Yeah, I agree with that. Legendary Defender has a...
Should we actually describe the plot of Voltron?
Yeah, like just in general terms, not really series specific, because they're basically the same.
Yeah, you can explain both series with the same premise.
Yeah, so you've got a kingdom in route. Well, you know, the more I think about it, the more let's go with Beast King first, and then draw the differences, I guess, from Legendary Defender. There's a very important thing about Beast King Go Lion that is not present in either the old version of Voltron or this version of Voltron. With Beast King Go Lion, this legendary robot basically went around the universe beating the crap out of anything it could find and, you know, proving its strength. And eventually it decided to take on the gods or goddesses.
The god, like the spirit of the universe. A big robot decided to take on the essence of the universe.
Yeah, pretty much. And the essence of the universe didn't appreciate that, and she basically just slapped him down, and Golion was split into five parts and ended up on the planet Altea, and so it sort of became this legendary thing from that point, and it sort of has some sort of connection to the Altean people because reasons, maybe. We think they sort of allude to the fact that they might have used it before, but you never really see anything explicit about it. And then the Galra Empire attacks and ruins Altea, and things are bad. And meanwhile, there are these five guys who are five happening dudes, all enslaved on a slave ship. But you can tell that they're the heroes because they each have their own distinctive outfits that are very emblematic of their character. And they basically super ninja their way out, and they end up meeting up with the Altean princess and all that, and then they get to form Voltron, and you know how the rest of this goes. So that's Beast King Golion. Voltron Legendary Defender is actually a bit different. You want to talk about the differences in setup of that?
In Voltron Legendary Defender, you basically start out with cadets, so you're starting with a younger set to begin with.
Yeah, they're explicitly students in Legendary Defender, where at Beast King, we don't know where the hell these guys came from. We've got no idea.
And you get this interspersed story between three closely knit cadets who are part of the same team, training to be fighter pilots, and this one captured slave of the Galran Empire who has just escaped and suddenly ends up crashing, surprise, surprise, right near the academy. And you also have, separate from those people, someone who's dropped out of the academy, former fighter pilot, who moves to intercept this crashed pilot out of just some sort of vague notion that he should. So that's how the team comes together in Legendary Defender. Once they're all assembled, they're drawn to this blue lion from some research that the outcast had been doing, and gain entry to it by intuition, and suddenly fly out, and they're drawn to Altea. And then they're captured. No, they're not captured. Are they captured? They're never captured, are they?
No, they're not. They're not captured. Well, they're they come into the castle and then they meet the princess right away, and she is quite a bit different from the princess you would remember from the old Voltron.
Seriously,
in very good ways. She also looks a disturbing amount like Mihoshi from Tenchi Muyo, but you know. We'll let that go because Mihoshi was great. But the princess basically puts Lance in an armbar and it's like, who are you people? Why are you in my castle? Why have you woken me up from my cryogenic sleep? Oh God, I've been asleep for 10,000 years. This is not good. Which is another big difference from Beast King Golion.
Cause huge, because the princess is like, actually, it's happening in real time, so yeah. She's been growing up since this baby that the Galran Empire just passed over. She grew up for 15 years while her planet was decimated, and that's how she greets the new visitors who are to be the paladins, the pilots. And she's just, oh, you're able people. Welcome. Please pilot our super-powered robot.
Yeah. But incidentally, the five guys in Beast King Golion are way more competent than people in Legendary Defender.
Yeah, well, they're established fighter or space crew. They're not actually fighters, but they are established pilots.
Pidge is literally in Beast King Golion descended from ninjas.
Yep.
And it shows. They're like 70s super robot badass level protagonists, basically. And the people in Legendary Defender, the cadets in Legendary Defender, they're much more, starting to figure it all out and are new. With the exception of Shiro, who is, of all of the characters between old Voltron and new Voltron, Shiro is probably the one who has had the most kind of redone to them in the reboot. So in original OG Voltron, he's called Sven.
Oh, God.
Even though he's wearing not a very Swedish outfit.
But he has a very Swedish voice.
Does he ever have a very Swedish voice? Man. Painfully so. By the way, the names in Beast King Go Lion, we're going to go with the Voltron names, because the names in Beast King Go Lion, frankly, are terrible.
Well, they sound like, Snow White's dwarves, like a short list of her favorite dwarves.
Yeah.
There's quiet, moody,
Shorty.
I will say, Chibi as opposed to Pidge, I think both are acceptable.
Yeah.
I can get behind someone just calling him Chibi.
I don't know, man.
There's also a huge difference in Chibi, because Chibi in one series has a few extra parts than Chibi in the other series.
That is true. We'll talk more about that later. Like, the cast is like very, personality wise, they're very similar to their original incarnations. Hunk is a bit more of a, he has a personality like a character you see in every Pixar movie, like where it's some big lumbering like dinosaur or monster or something, and they're very self-conscious about what they're doing, and they have lots of like quirks. Like, he's motion sick like really bad, and he pretty much spends the first two or three episodes just being motion sick from being in lions or in spaceships.
But he's not that flat, because he's also a huge tech nerd.
He is.
Or a mechanical nerd.
Yeah. No. He points out some things. It's kind of weird.
Science,
like, he just
nerd. Science, yeah, nerd.
He just kind of drops knowledge like randomly. You know, he's like, oh yeah, this is a this and this, and this is how you can see this mountain range over here, and blah. And he actually is kind of instrumental in them finding the first line in the first place. So I guess to revise my prior statement, that the characters are very much, they have a lot of the same core personality traits as their original incarnations, but there's also more to them.
And that's what I really liked about this, even though they kind of fall back on bordering on tropey, they did actually add some depth to them to avoid it.
Yeah. Like, even, I guess if there's one who's the closest to his original self, it's probably Lance. Lance is still pretty much Lance, but like more Lance.
A little angrier?
Yeah, a little angrier. So you know, they call him Moody in Beast King Go Lion. He lives up to that in Legendary Defender. He's definitely positioned as sort of the rival to Keith. Even though in Legendary Defender, it's Shiro who, because he's the only actual not cadet and is a real soldier, he's the leader of the team. And he's got some interesting things going on with him, to kind of go back to him being so different. He's got a cybernetic arm.
That was installed while he was a slave of the Gowron Empire.
Yeah. The only one of the characters in the current cast to have actually been a slave like the originals. And there's also some scrambly bits in his brain that he doesn't remember all of his past. So we get to delve into that over the course of the series, and that's pretty cool.
You mean he has amnesia?
Dun, dun, dun. You know, like, I'm not gonna pretend like Legendary Defender is like HBO original series level depth of characterization or anything like that. It's not, but they do a much more solid job of creating more rounded characters and giving characters like the princess. Allura has so much more agency in Legendary Defender. There's still a couple things that happens that are like, yeah, okay, you know, like, you know, there's a part where they have to save her, and it's like, okay, but the circumstances around which she has to be saved are actually kind of cool. She does some heroic stuff, and you know, sort of takes a hit for the team, so to speak, and then they decide that they have to go back and save her, because obviously. So the way they handle her is much better.
See, I'd actually argue. I don't know if it's better, but it definitely is different, because what I really liked about Beast King Go Lion is the fact that, yeah, this is sort of an oblivious princess who is, you know, people, the men come to the rescue, and it is all men in coming to the rescue in Beast King Go Lion, but at the same time, one of that crew dies, and she takes the place. And she mans one of the, she's one of the first to man the guns outside of the castle against a Gowron attack before she takes that place. So she's not helpless, but you know she's a member of the royal family on a planet that you know has been decimated and just the whole planet needs help, and she's representative of that. So kind of excuses why she is sort of that maiden in distress. It's not a maiden in distress, it's a planet in distress.
But, to a degree. I mean, you still have a scene when her nanny comes back and, like, literally gives her a spanking. With that, all the rest of the cast going, ah, you know, like...
Yeah, that was horrible.
They spend a lot of time saying, you know, not treating her like an equal or not treating her seriously. And, you know, we watched about 12 episodes of Go Lion. And by episode 12, you're finally getting to the point where they're like, yep, okay, she's definitely part of the team. She definitely can hold her own. You know, she is the pilot of the Blue Lion, like, hands down. She's the person. But, like, the road there is fraught with, oh, honey, don't strain yourself, or... You know, think about your position and how you're the symbol of all of the Altaian people's hopes, and you know, or what happens to the Altaian Empire if you can't go do this thing that you very obviously need to do because literally no one else can, or you know.
But I found that kind of realistic, though. Like that's a very realistic royal court attitude, and especially given the fact that this planet has just been pummeled after it's been discovered that Voltron is, you know, now protecting this planet. That was once thought totally, you know, conquered. The Gowron Empire returns and just pummels this planet with, was it Death Black Beastmen?
Yes, best name ever.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah, but that's what Roe Beasts are called in Beast King Go Lion.
But it's just pummeled one attack after the other, and when they finally achieve some sort of peace, and the subjects who were in caves are finally coming out and accepting food and stuff from the castle, you know, sending your princess out to be decimated is an actual fear, because she's the last of the bloodline. So all these people who have suddenly glimpsed this little ray of hope and who could fight back, possibly, you know, if that was to be taken away from them, they'd be right back to where they began. So I found that really realistic. I actually admired that about Beast King Go Lion.
That I will grant you. That point I'll grant you. I feel like in general, it's very kind of the time it's made in.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
And like you said, that nanny deserved the bullet through the head she gets. It's like, a little later than episode 13. I forget. I don't know when it actually happens. I haven't watched that far deep yet.
It's down the road. But I think Allura in Legendary Defender, she sort of comes right out as someone who can take care of herself, and she's a vital member of the team in terms of the fact that she has to, you know, basically Allura, like, mans the castle in Legendary Defender. And the castle is not just, so it looks kind of cool and awesome right from the beginning, whereas in Beast King Go Lion and in original Voltron, it doesn't. It actually, you know, the super fancy space fantasy castle kind of comes up out of the rubble of the old ruined castle, but the castle in Legendary Defender is also, well, there's more to it than meets the eye, but she's basically vital to powering that thing and manning its defenses and all that stuff. So right out from the bat, even though she doesn't have a lion, you know, at least not yet, she is, you know, contributing at a high level. And even kind of, you know, providing a leadership role to a degree, you know, in terms of the, you know, where Shiro might be the leader on the ground, she's sort of the overall kind of, you know, here's why we're fighting and what we need to be fighting for type person. You know, now they also kind of make her a bit hard to deal with, in the beginning of Legendary Defender, because she's, you know, these five guys show up and, you know, Shiro knows how to be a soldier, but the rest of them don't. And then she sort of expects them to just jump into their role as paladins and, like, begin training like they're in the army and everything. And it was kind of neat to see in Legendary Defender the team take more time to really gel and come together, because it takes several episodes, really, for that to happen all the way. Whereas in Beast King Go Lion, you know, it's pretty much like they don't even need practice forming Voltron. Like,
yeah.
Like they just do it. And then like, oh, here's the blazing sword. Nah, we're going to just chop somebody. And, you know, like they have like all of the epic competence that super robot heroes from that time in Japanese anime have. So it was neat to see the Legendary Defender cast really have to grow into their roles as paladins. And by the end of the first season, they're all, you know, they've caught up to the Beast King folks and maybe even surpassed them a little bit.
There's a parallel there that I really liked, because it takes, whereas Legendary Defender evolves the team, Beast King Go Lion evolves, well, I guess also the team. But they do it in a different way, because where Legendary Defender has to bring these individuals together to work together, Beast King Go Lion has to make these people competent enough to finally escape the planet and become Defender of the Universe.
Right.
Because they're under constant barrage of attacks, and they literally cannot have any time to themselves to actually go out and do stuff for other people. They're just so they're inundated with, you know, hell black, death black beastmen and the war fighters and all that, and they can't concentrate on anything else. So they you know, it's a struggle to actually get out and do better for the universe, as opposed to just work together, which has already been established. So both grow at, I think, relatively the same rate, but it's just a different, slightly different means.
Yeah, it is neat to see their evolution.
Because in Legendary Defender, they're off the planet, I think, in episode 2 or 3.
Yeah, well, I mean, even to find, so they have one thing they have very much in common is they have to, both teams and both shows have to find the lions. But with Beast King Go Lion, the lions are just on the planet, and there's a couple of them are in some not ideal places. And then they sort of hand wave away the finding of the lions. They kind of just tell them, yeah, one's in some lava, one's underwater, one's like under this big rock that looks like a lion, one's in the woods. And then, you know, we have sort of a, you know, smash cut to, oh, okay, you've got the lions, now let's get out there.
That's established as infrastructure, though. Like that,
it is.
That castle was like, or it is, the route to the lions. So it makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can hop in the, you know, obviously the transformation sequence that we're subjected to every time. You have to hop in the little cars and go down the tunnel.
If you want to save some serious time while marathoning the show, just skip the boarding sequences and the transformation sequence.
Oh God, yeah. Yeah, you'll probably cut that episode down to, you know, if you cut out the, you know, by the point I was watching it, you know, trying to get ready for the show, I had seen the opening enough, which, you know, after you see it a couple times and chuckle, it's great, and then you move on, and then the ending, cut that out, and then if you cut out the transformation sequence, you're probably looking at a good
12 to 15.
Yeah, 12 to 15 minutes of actual show.
What I also wanted to add was the fact that when Voltron split originally after challenging the universe itself, I like that Legendary Defender has it go all over the universe. You said, because it's not as easily just on the planet already. But like you said, the original does make mention of the previous use of Ultron on Altera, so it kind of makes sense that it's already assembled there.
I think what their reasoning was for having the Lions be all over the place in Legendary Defender, because these Paladins have existed before, right? Mm-hmm. So I think they even mentioned this, like it's a throwaway line or something, but you know, to hide the Lions from the Galra Empire, they kind of just threw them out randomly across the universe, and it was going to take, you know, the pilot being able to find them, you know, and like...
Defender or Golion?
Oh, wait, no. That was Golion, where they kind of instinctually found them.
That was Defender.
No, Defender, they had the star map thing, and they could find them all but the red... Was it the Red Lion? Yeah, they could find them all but the Red Lion.
Yeah.
But they
relied heavily on their own instincts to attract them to the Lion.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, like, the Lions have to... You have to have the mystical bond with the Lions to like, open them up and get them to work and stuff. That's the same in both series. So, I mean, this is definitely... Voltron in all its incarnations... it's definitely space fantasy. Like, there's a little tiny bit more explaining things in Legendary Defender than there is Beast King Golion. Beast King Golion, it's just, you know, magic, whee, stuff happens.
It's you know, insert into, you know, really easily identifiable circumstance. Like, okay, big overlord is attacking. We need something to counter that. But I like the way the series... individually or separately attacks that.
Yeah. You know, another character I think gets a better due. This is going to be odd, but it's the Galran Emperor.
Really?
Like the Galran Emperor in Beast King Golion, at least up into the episodes we've seen, he's more of a like head of the Department of Evil. He's like the general manager of the Department of Evil, and he kind of sits on a throne and goes, "Why are we not killing the Golion people? Kill them harder. Do stuff, crazy witch Honerva woman."
Hang on.
And in Legendary Defender, he does things. He encounter like a big difference in Legendary Defender and Golion, at least at the point in time that we stopped, is in Legendary Defender, the Emperor, the Galran Emperor, actually fights.
And he's a badass.
Yeah, and like, and it's kind of like this thing where like it's him against Keith in the Red Lion, and the Galran Emperor isn't like, he's not turned into a robeast or anything. He's not like crazy. He's just him, and he's a dude, and he's holding his own against the Red Lion.
Yeah.
Now part of that is Keith's in over his head. Well, yeah, a little bit. Part of that's Keith's in over his head. The other part, I'm not going to tell about the context of it. I'm just going to say it happens. The other part is that the guy's a badass. I mean, he's legit taking on a mecha by himself. So. Yeah, like, he's much cooler in Legendary Defender, and much more threatening a presence, I think. Whereas in Golion, he's just sort of he has a very managerial approach to his evil.
he is simply the king of evil, and, like, on that episode, it was edited out in Voltron, Guardian of the Universe, but there's one slave planet that's building this monument to him, and for his birthday he comes down and sees this monument, and while on that planet, Voltron I think finally escapes to help the other people, and that's the first time they leave that their Altea to actually help someone, and turns out to be this huge trap. But basically, I can't remember the Galran Emperor name.
Diabazal. In Golion, his name's Diabazal.
Oh, that's right, Diabazal. he basically shits himself and leaves.
Yeah.
And yeah. It's such a drastic difference with that and Golion. Golion's main meaning is so much better. Zarkon.
And, Yeah, Zarkon. Zarkon, Emperor Zarkon is a real threat. And Emperor Daibazal and Golion is really kind of just a figurehead who looks like a evil playing card. I mean, he really doesn't do anything other than sit on a throne. Now, the witch in both series is absolutely amazing and a super threat. To the point in Beast King Golion, she casts a spell on Golion and basically stuns him, stuns the whole robot. And frequently she's the one who's kind of engineering the demise of the crew of Golion, and she actually succeeds in the case of their version of Shiro, which another key difference between the two, and maybe a bit of a spoiler, but Shiro does not die in season one of Legendary Defender.
Season two, however, who knows?
Season two, who knows? Because by the end of season one, well, talk about that later.
Things aren't going so well for our heroes.
Yeah, there's some trouble in paradise, shall we say.
But getting back to Hagar, the witch, I absolutely loved both of the one-on-one fights that she has. There's only one in each series. But in Legendary Defender, she faces off against Shiro, and there's this really wonderful fluid animation in Shiro's scrambling that I loved. And, you know, the little cloudy wisps of smoke that Hagar disappears into with all her clones is, you know, neat, but, you know, I've seen it before to the effect that it wasn't really scary.
Mm-hmm.
Yet in Beast King Golion, it was the simplest animation of just sort of sliding paper dolls, making copies of each other.
Yeah.
And the way that's presented as surrounding the member of Ultron that she's battling was just a lot more scary to me. It was a lot scarier.
Yeah, no, it did feel a lot more sinister.
Might have been in the cackle, too.
Yeah, yeah. I did appreciate that Legendary Defender went out of their way to basically recreate that fight.
Yeah. Shiro in the Beast King?
Oh, okay. Slash Quiet slash Sven, but it's Shiro. It's their equivalent of Shiro. Mm-hmm. I had to stop myself because he doesn't actually pilot the Black Lion in Beast King Golion. But I felt like it was a bit more sinister in Golion because of the cackling. But I thought it was cool how they made absolutely sure to have that fight. And you get Shiro obviously survives that fight in Legendary Defender, but he gets some insight into some missing information that he didn't have about himself that was pretty interesting and sets up some interesting questions towards the end of the season and makes us wonder what's going to happen with season two.
Hmm.
But, I mean, obviously the people that made Legendary Defender watched and loved Voltron, and they put a lot of effort into it. It's a show that I think, it definitely has the feel of a very similar sensibility to, say, Avatar or Korra, because it's made by some of the same people. Whereas Beast King Golion is really freaking grim. It's really dark. People are getting killed and blown up and crushed.
And tortured.
Tortured, eaten. They're getting shot.
They're being stepped on, literally?
They're being stepped on. The equivalent of roe beasts in Golion are getting, I mean, the blazing sword, you see the whole thing. You see them get cut in half. You see them get their arms cut off, stabbed through the head. I mean,
these aren't robots, because you can't show a kid's show on television these days with actual, blood, people bleeding. So
right.
You replace them with robots. This was something made really evident in Samurai Jack. But in Beast King Golion, there is blood everywhere.
Yeah.
Everywhere. And Legendary Defender? Yeah, it's robots. They They at least there's a throwaway line describing that too. There's like, oh yeah, most of the force is, you know, sentries, and that sets it up nicely. Cause so you can have the people where you need people, but most of the people getting killed are robots.
Right, and that goes back to the creation of Voltron Defender of the Universe way back, because to make Voltron, they had to take Golion and basically get out all of the violent parts and recut and then basically rewrite the show. So Voltron, there's some really funny kind of things that happen to justify some of the scenes we still see in Voltron. Like, Ink, you were talking about, I think before we started recording, you were talking about the vulture thing.
Oh, God, yeah.
That's a great example.
Just to put it out there, like, honestly, you should just watch the first episode after you finish both of these wonderful series. But the first episode, which is highly cut together, features the space pilots in prison breaking out, and after, you know, for their escape, they latch onto vulture legs and glide down to this pit of death, where there's, you know, skeletal remains scattered all on the ground. It's basically all of the ground is skeletal remains. And in the original Beast King Golion, after landing on that, they lament all the death and they say a prayer for all those who have died. In Voltron, Guardian of the Universe, while gliding, right after being dropped off by the vultures, they go, "Wow, those vultures may not be pretty, but they sure helped us out a lot." And then they pray for no reason.
Yeah. I mean, it's really weird. You know, another interesting fact, you know, in doing research on Voltron Defender of the Universe and how it came about, two guys, Peter Keefe and John Teichman, I guess his name is. I don't know how to pronounce it. Hopefully I didn't butcher it. But basically, they wanted to do something similar to what Carl Masek was doing with Robotech. So they – and I don't know if they necessarily knew each other or they were aware of each other's efforts. I don't know. I wasn't able to do any kind of deep research to find out. But I thought it was interesting that – they wanted to adapt two Japanese super robot series. One was Future Robot Daltanius, and the other was Armored Fleet Dieruger 15. And when they were getting the initial concept for Voltron together, they were going to do like a one season, which was going to be like the Lion Team, right, with the footage from Future Robot Daltanius, which that super robot has a big lion head on the chest. And then the second season, they were going to do a vehicle team, which is the Armored Fleet Dieruger 15, which is the stuff that ended up being the second, quote-unquote, Voltron 2, right, that some of you guys may have seen in syndication, you know, way back in the mid-80s. You know, I think I saw one or two episodes myself, but anyhow, so when they were getting ready to start work on the Lion Force Voltron, they basically what happened is the Toei, who did these different series, sent instead of sending Future Robot Daltanius those tapes, they sent Beast King Golion because of sort of a miscommunication, where the producers basically asked for the ones with the lion, and, you know, assuming that they were going to get Future Robot Daltanius, instead they got Beast King Golion. And after they saw Beast King Golion, they said, "Oh my God, this is better than that Daltanius thing. Let's use that as our lion team." And then,
I mean, obviously, it's a robot made out of lions.
It's a robot made out of lions. So there's like 500% more lions than Beast King Golion. they took that, and I think it's something I read somewhere. I think they were actually going to do three different Voltron series, and the Lion Team was going to be Voltron 3. But they liked it so much, they actually made that the first one. And that's how we have the Voltron we have today. And yeah, I thought that was just an interesting kind of story. And it's so funny how this one thing, this one, oh yeah, send us the ones with the lion. And then, you know, there were probably multiple meetings held. What do they mean? Send us the ones with the lion. Oh, okay, we'll send, go lion. You know,
which was actually not a hugely popular property in Japan.
No,
as I hear, like that was the least popular robot show over there.
Yeah, yeah. So that there was a third mecha series or super robot series that they were going to use to do quote unquote Voltron 3 over here, and that was going to be based off of. And I had never heard of this in my life. Lightspeed Electroid Albagas. Yeah.
Words.
That sounds like a winner, doesn't it? But basically, by the time they really kind of got started with Voltron, in the United States, the recut of Beast King Go Lion, which became Defender of the Universe, was kind of unexpectedly popular, and they ran that, and then when they ran out of material to cut and rewrite into Voltron episodes, they started using the Armored Fleet Dairigger 15 stuff and made Voltron 2. And like I said, I think a few of us had seen that, you know, in the past. I had seen one or two episodes, and the only thing I could remember about the Dairigger era of Voltron was that they had rewritten it to where one of the kid characters in Dairigger 15 was the cousin of Pidge somehow, because reasons, right?
God, I actually do remember that.
Yeah, that's the only thing I remember. And I was like, and I remember as a kid seeing this and seeing it, you know, they were calling it Voltron, and I'm like, nah, this ain't Voltron. What is this crap with the cars? And so I guess I wasn't the only kid that thought that way. So instead of doing Lightspeed Electroid Albagas, which again, what a name, they actually worked with Toei to make Voltron, like actual, like original Voltron shows with the Go Lion stuff.
With Keith actually providing voices for multiple characters.
Yeah.
And man, if you watch that dub, you can tell.
Yeah, buddy. Because, wow. And so that's kind of a brief history of how Defender of the Universe came about, you know, randomly. But it's kind of crazy how these happy accidents happen.
Thank God they did.
Yeah, no kidding.
Without stuff like Starship Crusaders, was it Yamato?
Starblazers.
Starblazers. Without stuff like Starblazers and Transformers and Voltron, anime might not have caught on so quickly, in quotes, over here.
Yeah, I mean, it's
like those are the roots of fandom, as what with the early syndication and those who, you know, got the tapes from Japan and started fan subbing. But you know, now everything is available here, like legally to watch. We're watching like there are 50 shows a season, and we watch most of them.
Yeah.
Or we can watch most of them. It's an amazing thing, and we owe it to people like, you know, Peter Keefe, who saw the potential in these series.
That's absolutely true. You know, if you think back to childhood, Starblazers, I think that, you know, people slightly older than us caught the Starblazers stuff. You might have seen it.
I saw it in syndication. It was the first show on Saturday morning. It was like 5:30 in the morning, and they were showing Starblazers on TV and one of the UHF channels.
Yeah, I never quite caught Starblazers, but Voltron for sure, and then of course Robotech, which was, you know, I feel like I saw that slightly later, like maybe 86 or 87, but you know, like you said, without these folks like Peter Keefe, who knows what, how anime fandom would have evolved, or if it would have, you know, evolved quite as quickly as it did without exposing our generation to this great stuff like Beast King, Go Lion, and Defender of the Universe, and then we get now Voltron Legendary Defender because of it. You know, speaking of voice actors and how Peter Keefe did a ton of voices for Voltron, I was just in doing research for the show. So Legendary Defender has a couple of well-known actors, like actors in roles, in voice roles. One of which is the voice actor for Keith is actually, I think his name's Steven Yuen, who's Glenn from The Walking Dead. Oddly, randomly enough. And the voice of Corin, the mustachioed strategist guy, who's sort of Princess Allura's right-hand man. In Legendary Defender, the voice of that character is provided by the great Rhys Darby, who, if you've seen Flight of the Conchords, and I hope you have, is in Flight of the Conchords. He's like their manager guy, and he's hilarious. So that was really cool.
He brings the comedy in the show. There's a lot of in Legendary Defender. There's comedy spread throughout, but largely him. He's like the comedic relief guy.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the comedy is sort of written between the characters of the main crew.
Right. Right. And there's a lot more comedy in Legendary Defender than Beast King Go Lion.
There is comedy.
Well,
in Voltron Legendary Defender.
Yeah, I mean, like the comedy in Beast King Go Lion is like a couple of facial expressions here and there, and then okay, it's back to the slaughterhouse. Or
the over-exaggerated instances of the maid, which was put in there for comedic relief, I guess, but it really is just sexist and horrible.
It's very terrible. On the Beast King Go Lion side of things, the voice actor or actress for Pidge, a.k.a. Shorty, a.k.a. Chibi, is Masako Nozawa, who you have heard before, I guarantee you, because she is also the voice of Doraemon and also the voice of Goku from Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z. And she's even the voice today on Dragon Ball Super. So she is still working. And she voices Goku, Gohan, and Goten. But if you watch Beast King Go Lion and you hear Shorty / Pidge starting to talk, you're like, oh, God, I've heard that voice. And so that's kind of what prompted it. And then that was how I found out, oh, my God, she's basically the Judi Dench of Japanese voice actors.
And all that experience counts.
Yeah, yeah.
I also want to talk about the focus of the show's dealing with technology and mysticism, because I marathoning both of these shows, I just really noticed in Beast King Go Lion, you see a show that's sort of obsessed with technology, because it's the focus of the show. There's this, you know, war-decimated place, which is one thing, but the real attention grabbers are the Galron ships and the spaceships and the huge robot made out of lions in this really ultra-realistic world, but this very realistic war-torn world. Mm-hmm. And in Legendary Defender, the tech is so integrated, it's just commonplace. And really, that forces the focus on all the mystical elements, like Hagar's spells and this sort of draw towards the lions, the sense of being sort of at the will of the universe. Whereas Beast King Go Lion, all that technological focus put the focus on, you know, just sort of being human and working with stuff.
Yeah.
Not stuff working for you.
Yeah. That's a really interesting parallel to raise. You know, I think the way that the technology is framed in Go Lion is more like that's like a shining point of light in a sea of just hopelessness. You know, in Go Lion, Earth has basically been decimated by a nuclear holocaust. And in the first episode of Golion, they're very clear and explicit about that. They show you multiple images of people being blown up by nuclear bombs, including a baby. It's great. And they really kind of drive home that, you know, civilization is basically over in the universe. And then there's this one tiny ray of hope that comes in the form of, you know, the Altaian castle, and the lions themselves. And, you know, Beast King Golion is at least in the 12 episodes, we saw much more about climbing back out of the abyss, you know, basically. And you really feel like there's the whole universe is being oppressed, and all you've got are this band of, you know, five people, and a couple of their, you know, supporting cast, against this vast empire. And you know, in human terms, it does kind of make it seem like, you know, it had sort of a more of an apocalyptic, pessimistic view, you Definitely. Know, at least in the backdrop. And then it's more hopeful in terms of the characters. But in Legendary Defender, humanity is fairly well advanced, and, you know, they're organized, and there's, you know, there's lots of space stuff going on, and it's a lot more optimistic, just in general.
And you know what I think that owes to? In Legendary Defender, Earth is still safe.
Yeah.
In Beast King Golion, Earth has been conquered. It's part of the Galarian Empire. That's where a lot of the slaves came from. But in Defender, you know, these heroes come from a place of well-being. They're, you know, there in our world, because we are obviously meant to associate with these characters. Are coming from a safe place. They have some player to go back to. And Beast King Golion, there's nowhere to go.
Yeah. Yeah. Altaia is probably the closest we're ever going to get to having a new home for humanity. And it almost makes it feel like a, you know, a hopeful kind of dream, you know?
Which is what makes episode 6 so bloody wonderful.
Yes. Okay, let's talk about episode 6 of Beast King Golion, because I think that's probably both our favorite episode. It's the one with the is it the one with the fire rain?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's
because so to set up why this episode is so effective. It's one of the first episodes where the Altaian people, the few who have survived Galra's attacks, who have been living in caves and sort of shy away from any other entity that touches down on the planet's surface, finally is being coaxed out to the castle and to the royal family because of Voltron's protection and belief and hope. And while, you know, out there on some just random Wednesday, it suddenly starts raining blood. And that blood turns into Agent Orange. And everyone's on fire. Or running from the fire. Or stampeding over your fellow people who are running from trying not to be on fire.
Yeah, and, you know, for the most part, Golion is a Monster of the Week show where the Death Black Beast people get more and more absurd looking, like, all the time. This episode, it has one of those in there, but it's almost like a throwaway thing at the end.
Oh, it's totally. That's why I loved it. This is people versus environment versus people versus monster.
Yeah, and it's so much more effective. Because the lions really, there's not a whole lot the lions are able to do. You know, they spend most of the show being kind of helpless, trying to put the fires out, and they continue to not succeed. They eventually find a way through it, but, you know, Beast King Golion, it really, to me, it feels more effective when the bad guys are not just throwing another monster at them. And there's a few episodes where they try different things, but that one is really good just because of, like what Ink said, they were just getting out of living out of fear, you know, and feeling like that they had a chance to start putting things back together with Altaian civilization again. And here's a rain of fire in the sky. And it's kind of the episode. One of the things that stood out to me about that episode is it starts off and the princess is sort of fascinated by this rain. And she's like, oh, it's so pretty. It's like, you know, strawberry juice, you know. And now keep in mind, Go Lion Princess is 15-year-old kid, kind of sheltered. She's starting to learn how to be a pilot and everything, but still has some naive moments. And, you know, the strategist guy in that series is like, oh, I don't think that's strawberry juice, princess. I don't know. It just, like, really kind of jarred me for some reason.
I love that.
Yeah.
There's also, in that episode, there's a woman who separated from her daughter. And that actually becomes a plot point because then they have to swap one for the other.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And as soon as that child and mother were separated, they focus on the child getting away or being left behind. And I'm just thinking to myself, oh, God, given the point of this episode, they're just going to kill that kid, aren't they? But no, they actually don't. And they let her survive all the way until the end where she's being traded for her mother. And then they shoot the mother.
Yeah.
Because it's Go Lion.
Yeah, because, you know, there are slightly more happy endings in Go Lion than there are in Yami Shibai, but not many.
Would you say there's a parallel episode in Legendary Defender?
With the, the parallel episode to the Raining Fire episode?
Yeah.
Yeah, like the castle episode, right? You talking about the one where the castle gets hacked?
That could be.
So there's an episode where early on in Legendary Defender, Pidge, which let's establish something right now. Pidge is the MVP of Legendary Defender and Defender of the Universe, and probably Beast King Go Lion. Pidge is the best character, period. I'm sorry if anybody likes anybody other than Pidge. Pidge is the best. Anyway, Pidge finds this Galren drone thing in like the first episode and then hacks it and turns it into his kind of pet, like Rover, basically. That's what he names it, is Rover. And, you know, he's using that a lot. Well, eventually the Galrens figure out, oh, this kid hacked some of our devices, one of our little drone robots. We can hack back into it and then sabotage the castle that way. And by that point in the show, when they figure this out, you know, the people of I think in Legendary Defender they actually call the planet Eris. The people of Eris are starting to come out of their shells and go to the castle of lions and, like, you know, feel sort of safe. And the princess hosts this big banquet for everybody. And
saying, we'll protect you. Come, yeah. celebrate your protection.
Yep. And then they use the drone that so far has been a helpful little pet to Pidge they turn it into I think like a bomb or something that, like, blows up something. Yep. In the castle, and it puts the whole thing on lockdown and renders it useless, which
blows up the power crystal.
Yeah, which critically means they can't, like, go get in their lines because the power's out. So the Galren general guy, who's named Syndak in Legendary Defender, who's pretty cool, actually. He's a whole lot cooler than he is in Go Lion. In Go Lion, he's just a poor schmuck. But, you know, he leads in a squad to attack, and there's, like, this, you know, kind of cat and mouse kind of game that ends up going on with basically without, like, telling you everything that happens in the episode. There's, you know, Pidge has got some turmoil. He's kind of uncomfortable with just hanging around the Castle of the Lions and training and getting ready to go fight the Galrens. He wants to go find his father and his brother. And So he's had some angst. He's getting ready to leave the team, and he was about to announce it when all this stuff goes down. And he gets – everybody else is either subdued or captured or trapped. And it's basically – he's the only one that's free, and it's him versus Syndak and Syndak's squad of Galran soldiers. And Pidge basically outsmarts and outplays his way around – to getting things back up and running with a little bit of help.
It's so much fun to watch him do so.
Yeah. And then, of course, once the castle's turned back on, the tables are turned, and Syndak has to live to fight another day. Well, I guess we'll talk more about that in a minute, too. Yeah, so another episode where Pidge is the MVP, just like he was in Beast King Go Lion, and... yeah, Pidge is the greatest.
So I'm going to take that opportunity just to say, okay, we're going to enter spoiler territory, because we've been using him for Pidge, him and he and male pronouns, but Pidge in Legendary Defender is actually a woman, and I love the fact that she's not hiding out as a woman in a man's army. She's hiding from a very specific person. She just sort of changed her appearance to avoid being noticed by someone who had banished her from the academy previously.
Yeah, she's basically like assumed another identity.
Yeah,
trying to sneak back into the academy as a cadet and figure out what happened to her father and her brother, who were on a crew with Shiro out near Pluto in something very specific that's a space thing that I can't remember off the top of my head right now.
It was the mission to an outer planet to gather samples.
Yeah.
Scientific expedition.
Yeah. So the Galrans capture that crew, which includes Pidge's dad, we're using her now because she's a girl, captures her dad, captures her brother, and then captures Shiro. And that's sort of the connection that Pidge has to the story. And Pidge and Shiro actually end up having a kind of a bond because of that. That's pretty cool. Which will be made all the more tragic once Shiro goes nuts and tries to kill them all. It's going to be great. Because Shiro, now that we're in full-blown spoiler territory, Shiro's cybernetic arm is a souvenir of the time that he was basically a gladiator in the Galran fighting pits. And he became, like, the prize gladiator. He was the champion. And the druids, which I love that they use like the word druid to suggest some sort of occult, super science, fantasy, magic, sci-fi magic stuff. I don't know why, because they're in space, and it just seems like such a totally, completely opposite term of what you would use. But
space druid and space explorer, I mean, that's kind of parallel.
Yeah, I guess so. If you're looking at a druid as like someone cultivating space stuff, I don't know.
Space traveler. You
know. But anyway, Shiro gets the cybernetic arm. It's Galran technology. His, when we meet him at the beginning of the series, he's got amnesia. He's got plot amnesia, of course. But his cybernetic arm, and he's able to control Galran stuff. And at one point in the series, they capture Syndak, and they're going to basically hack into Syndak's cybernetic parts to get intelligence on the Galran Empire and learn how they can defeat the Galrans, and critically for Pidge, hopefully find out where his dad and brother, where her dad and brother are. And in the process of all that getting figured out, Shiro tries to hack into Syndak, or accidentally hacks into him, and downloads a lot of Syndak's memories and stuff. And so, like, he's got all that rolling around in his head, and on top of that, he's starting to remember some of the darker parts of his past that he had kind of had sealed away. And when we see him fight Hagar the Witch later in the series, she alludes to the fact that, you know, he's a fool and he doesn't even know what he's doing, and that
he's under the control.
Yeah.
Or still under.
He's a puppet, basically.
He's more susceptible to being manipulated.
Yeah.
Because of his past.
And so by the end of season one, we're very clearly seeing Shiro starting to sort of have mental breakdown a bit. Which is bad because, you know, and it's so much more powerful than what happened with his analog character in Beast King Golion, because you've had a whole season of him being sort of the older brother leader figure for the other four guys, and particularly Pidge. He's got this real tight bond with Pidge, and when he inevitably flips his lid and something happens and he dies or something, then, you know, it's going to be awful. Like, it's going to be really impactful, and I'm kind of looking forward to it. Season one just does a lot of good, like, foundational setting the groundwork for some cool stuff to happen in season two. And we also find out that Allura, besides looking like Nihoshi, also can sort of alter her body, like mass and color and stuff.
And size.
Yeah. And she ends up they have to sneak onto a Galarin ship or Galarin mining colony thing. And she takes the appearance of a Galarin soldier, you know, puts on a uniform and everything, makes her look like that. She also has, like, super strength, basically. And so the part that we talked about earlier where she gets captured, she basically, her and Shiro are trying to hold off a squad of Galarin soldiers
for the rest of the team to escape.
And basically, she decides that, you know, he pilots one of the lions, he needs to be saved. So she bodily picks up Shiro, who's not a little guy, and, like, throws him with one arm, like, into, I think it's the green lion that they use to sneak in there.
I think it was an escape shuttle.
Or was it an escape shuttle?
She throws him into an escape.
Oh, that's thing. Right. That's right.
A thing.
Keith is the one that gets picked up with the green lion in that. She's super strong. So, like, Allura in Legendary Defender is pretty much a grown woman who's come into her own, and, you know, is kind of badass. And, you know, they're definitely setting her up for a bigger and more central role later when Shiro probably becomes unable to pilot the Black Lion. And I think that provides a very open question. But maybe we can save that for, like, our season two talk. I think did you have anything else you want to talk about that spoiler territory before we go into questions?
Yeah, because along the same conversion of character, we had mentioned that Zarkon is a complete badass in Legendary Defender. And it turns out he's also the former paladin of the Black Lion. Which is kind of how he's able to take on that huge robot by himself, or the lion by himself, because he still has what they call, like, I forget what it's the paladin's...
The Bayard?
The weapon. The Bayard. Which holds, like, transformational properties, so it can become a sword or a gun or, you know, something specific to whoever holds it. And was his just, like, this huge beam-forming weapon?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Just this beam that could cut through, like, an entire space station, the ring of an entire space station. And that brought me back to the magical weapons in Beast King Golion, because those were the most idiotic things in that series. Would just be, the lions would be flying around, and all of a sudden there'd be this cannon that materialized on the side of the lion. It's like, okay.
Yes.
At least in Legendary Defender, most of the weapons are organic. Okay, there's a beam that comes out of the lion's mouth. Okay, that's an integral part of the machine. I can buy that. The laser comes out of the tail, etc. Their claws and stuff.
Right.
Only a couple times do like their special blades materialize in their mouth, and that's all due to the Bayard. The Bayard's influence. So, okay, this magical thing causes magical things to happen. I can buy that.
And they're reflective of the personality of the paladin that's using them too, I think.
Yeah. But I liked how Legendary Defender improved on that, and I loved how that final fight with Zarkon goes down.
Oh, it's awesome. It's awesome. That's the best fight in the series so far, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah. I mean, camera work is great on that, too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they really kind of outdid themselves at that, and it's, you know, I felt like the first few episodes they were kind of finding their feet as a show, but by the end of the first season, it really feels like they know who they are, and you know, as a production staff and as the story they're telling, and it gets good. It just gets good. I did not think I was going to like that show as much as I do.
Me either. And I went as much as to the nostalgia trip as I do, you know, what they actually did. So that's a really competent show.
Yeah. I mean, they took all of the stuff that we liked and remembered about Voltron, and
wasn't much.
Yeah. And they added a layer of depth to it, and then in addition to that, they built a lot of world building. There's a lot more world building in Legendary Defender in the amount of time that we have relative to what we see in Golion. Not saying there's not world building in Golion. There definitely is. The pace is a lot slower. Now, it also ended up going for like 50-something episodes. But yeah.
What we watched was probably a season.
Yeah. Yeah, probably.
Didn't necessarily constitute an arc.
It felt like a bookend. That 12th episode feels like a bookend, but it doesn't, you know, to your point, it doesn't feel like an end of an arc. Golion feels a bit more unconnected, like the episodes are feel a bit more unconnected. That there's a progression to them that's logical, but it's not like watching something like Legendary Defender where there's a very clear through line that goes through that whole season. But, yeah, it's just a surprisingly impressive show, and I don't mean that in the it's a surprisingly impressive show for an American animation thing, because, you know, for one thing, a lot of the staff here are the same staff from Avatar and from Korra. Those shows, particularly Avatar, I would take Avatar against just about anything, and I know that I probably just guaranteed some hate mail for myself there, but
send that same hate mail to me.
I mean, these are great animators, and they know what they're doing, and it really shows in the execution of Legendary Defender. It's really good. Really good.
Watch the show.
Yeah, do it. Do it. It's fun.
All episodes right now streaming on Netflix.
I mean, hell, if Ink is going to watch a robot show, all you robot people damn well better watch that show. All you non-robot people better damn well watch that show. I mean, it's great. It's worth your time. It's worth your time. And I'll tell you something, you know, this is a great example of a show with strong anime roots.
I thought you were going to go for female characters, man.
It's got some great female characters in it.
Are they strong?
They're badass. They're more than one note. I'm not going to use that word, they're very enjoyable. Pidge is still my favorite character. I love her even more now because there's so much more depth to, and not because of her gender, but just because of her story has so much more depth to it. And it's really great.
Shall we take some questions about the great show?
Yes, we shall. Now let's see. I think one of the earliest ones I saw was from our friend Corey.
Yes.
Of the Taiku podcast, which you should all listen to for sports anime that isn't always necessarily sports anime, but it's still really good.
His question was, how do the robots' designs compare?
The robots, yeah.
Robots.
You
are a resident giant robot expert, sir. Please do go ahead with your impressions.
Okay, well, so I did some research because I wanted to see what the producers of Legendary Defender thought about the designs, because they're a bit different. The thing that I think, if I'm speaking for most people from our generation, that you remember about Voltron is you remember how unique and idiosyncratic the Voltron design is. There is nothing like that design. And like even the, you know, when you see other super robot shows from that vintage, you know, there somebody who's more knowledgeable of super robots may be able to find me an example of something that's more ornate than that. I think when you get into the Brave series, you start to see some stuff like that. But outside of the Brave series, I can't think of a super robot that is as ostentatious as Voltron, the original Voltron. So the Legendary Defender design, by contrast, is a lot more streamlined. It is a lot more, you know, it's a lot sleeker looking. It's not nearly as boxy. The arms and the legs don't look like just big square posts that go into lion bodies.
And actually, you know what I loved about the differences between Legendary Defender and Golion was the effort into the transformation sequence itself, because you have CG lions coming together to form, but you also have what looks at least to be hand-drawn mechanics.
Yeah.
These interlocking gears and the way the claws actually fit inside the tubes of the other lion and get locked down by several sliding gates, and just sort of gives it a nice realism as to how these things are actually able to hold together as a unit.
I'm glad you said that, because that was, I actually, the first time I watched Legendary Defender, I didn't do it this time, but the first time I watched it, that transformation sequence, those mechanical parts, I watched those over and over and over and over, because
they just look neat.
They were great, and they have a very much, you'll see that metallic sheen effect you see in a lot of old 80s hand-drawn anime in a couple spots. And it's hard to explain, but you'll know it when you see it. Yeah, the Legendary Defender Voltron looks like it fits together and it makes sense. Golion Voltron is just, it kind of goes together in a bullshit sort of way.
Well, it's very pagan slot and snap together.
And like
snap together robot.
Like the tails somehow magically, for the arms, the tails somehow magically become, you know, plugs that go into the body, and you know, the legs make sense. The legs are actually okay. Because you see the black lion legs go into the blue and yellow lion, and yeah, that makes sense. I can sort of, like, in my head canon, I could put in what Legendary Defender actually explicitly does and creates that interlocking sort of effect that shows the all the limbs fitting together.
I do want to add the fact that I'm sort of opposite on your opinion. I found the Legendary Defender lions themselves to look sort of Lego-ish. Like, if all Lego pieces were smooth on top, but the overall design, that result on the overall design, I would say that looked very Lego-ish. And the original, the Golion, just seemed rougher, more maney, looked more animalistic.
Yeah. Now, that I do agree with that. And, I mean, Legendary Defender, they go out of their way to say that each lion has a specific, like, tactical focus, right? So, like, the yellow lion, has more armor than the other lions because it's sort of the heavy, you know, kind of just like Hunk.
And that the designs really do reflect that a lot better than in Go Lion.
Yeah, the lions in Legendary Defender all look different. They all look distinctive, and the two leg lions in Go Lion basically look the same. The two arm lions basically look the same, and then the black lion looks different from everything else. But
although I will say, in terms of the black lion between Go Lion and Legendary Defender in the latter, those huge back red wings, mm-hmm. wing-like things, which actually come together to form a shield. And I'm not sure if they do that in Go Lion or not, but I really love the hell out of those.
Yeah.
Those looked massive and bulky and beautiful. And when they form that shield, it gives that shield that sort of heft too.
Yeah.
So I did love that about that design.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that in one of the interviews I had read up on with the producers of Legendary Defender, they said they went through like 14 or 15 different iterations on Voltron. And but one thing that they really had to do away with was the collagen luscious lips that Voltron has in Legendary.
Is she Voltron?
Yeah, like he has like these really full lips, and they kind of get rid of that in Legendary Defender. I mean, he still has a face and a mouth, but it's not so ostentatious, I guess, as it is in Go Lion.
And it doesn't emote.
No, doesn't emote at all.
In Go Lion, for the large part, it doesn't emote, but there are certain instances where it like grins slightly or does the oh shit face.
Yeah.
And completely threw me off. I was like, wait, I thought it was stationary.
Right.
And if so, who is controlling that face? Because someone has to control everything on that robot, so who's making it do the oh shit face, and why aren't they focusing on fighting instead?
Super robot laws, man. Super robot laws. I mean, it's hard for me to say that, you know, I'm always going to be partial to the original Voltron because that thing is just, it's part of my childhood and it's so iconic to me. But I will say Legendary Defender for a modern robot looks pretty damn good. And the only complaint I have about Legendary Defender is the Blazing Sword is kind of plain looking compared to the insanely complex looking sword that Go Lion has. I do miss that sword. I wish Legendary Defender had that sword. But its sword is more of like a big broadsword type look, real wide blade. I think it even has like a squared, squared tip, you know.
Sort of a simple as opposed to ornate elegance.
Yeah, it's a very Phantasy Star Online kind of looking weapon. You know, it's a real, real modern looking space fantasy sword that's not a lightsaber. But yeah, the design of the robots to answer Corey's question, I think they did a pretty good job of updating it without completely, you know, ruining the character of it. You know, it doesn't have the big crest on the chest anymore. It has that kind of as an arm, like a shoulder pad type thing. But it looks pretty cool in its own right, I think.
And to just stretch out the question to encompass all character designs, I just want to say that all the main paladins, the pilots, are really close, save Shiro. And what I loved most, or what I laughed about most, was that they made all of Zarkon's immediate underlings, all the commanders, they made them furry.
Yeah.
Just noticeably furry, as opposed to, like, this hard purple skin. And I didn't know whether that was good or bad. It makes me laugh, but, like, they're more badass than they were. But now they're furrier too.
Yeah, they do way better alien designs overall with Legendary Defender, and we see lots more varieties of alien throughout their kind of travels in the first season. I agree with you. The redesign of the main pilots, with the exception of Shiro, who they basically just reworked, they're very close to the spirit of the originals, and I like what they did with Allura. Even made her less Disney princess looking. That was cool. Corrin basically he looks like a more modern, updated version of the mustachioed guy from Go Lion.
Also a little lankier, because
yeah,
that's adds to a little bit of the visual humor of his design. That huge handlebar mustache when on this lanky body.
Yeah, he looks less like he came out of a Dickens novel, in Legendary Defender. He has a very, just strangely out of place looking design for being in a space castle in Go Lion to me.
So let's move on to next question, or a series of questions by HissUERT.
Yes, Al, thank you for all of the questions, man. All of the questions.
I think we hit a vein here.
Yeah, he might like this show. So his first question, I think, was, did either of you watch Voltron when it was originally on the air in America?
I think we already covered that one.
Yeah. Did you watch it when Cartoon Network reran it years later?
That I have to say no. I didn't even remember them re-airing Voltron, Guardian of the Universe.
I think I remember hearing about it, but it's not something I watched at the time.
If I did, it would have ruined this rewatch for me, because the stark contrast of Voltron, Guardian of the Universe with Go Lion is just... I would have instantly hated the nostalgia trip.
Yeah, yeah.
Because as is, I don't think I'll ever go back and watch Voltron, Guardian of the Universe again. But I really want to finish Go Lion. I just watched those 12 episodes, but I'm like, okay, I want to see, kind of want to see the rest of it. Even though it's Monster of the Week, it's still, a hell of a lot better than the what I went back and rewatched.
Yeah. I absolutely agree. I think that not watching Voltron was the best thing, because I think if I was to sum up Legendary Defender, I think Legendary Defender marries Go Lion's sort of scale and the seriousness of the conflict together with a lot of the nostalgia, feel-good things that we liked about Voltron as kids growing up. And
I will agree, 1,000%.
I think that's why it works for me, is because it takes all the good stuff that we remember, and then it brings in some more serious stuff, kind of in the vein of Go Lion, without being just horribly depressing, and it just really makes it work. But anyway. What update about the show surprised you the most? That's a really good question. Ink, what about you? What surprised you the most?
I think I already hit on it, and I think it comes down to me the real focus on the show, the mysticism versus the technology, and which era was more obsessed with each. Because it ended up being totally contrary to what I would expect.
Yeah, okay. I think for me, what surprised me the most, what I didn't expect when I started watching Voltron, Legendary Defender, was there to be as much depth as there is. It's a cartoon and it's aimed at, young people, but it's got enough depth to it that, kind of like Avatar and Korra did, older folks can watch it and still be compelled to kind of keep watching it, because it's got good plot and it's got good characterization. So I'm not sure if that surprised me the most, or if how good of a job they did at keeping the spirit of the characters intact in the reboot. Because sometimes that's kind of how reboots live and die, is they'll get some of the superficial things right, but then they'll try to take the character in a whole new direction, and it's like, oh no, I didn't need edgy Pidge, man. I don't need I don't need Grimdark Pidge, you know?
His next question was, which line would you end up piloting?
I think I would end up piloting the Red Lion.
Because you're agile and agitated?
Just because it has an attitude problem, and so do I, so it works. I mean, like, you know, of all of them, that seems like the one I would gravitate the most towards.
I would definitely be in the yellow. I'd be in Hunk's line. I forget what the defining characteristics other than being like dependable and I think it was just sensitive and dependable, something like that.
Yeah, and it like could just like go through ships on its own because of all the extra armor. He did ask if we watched Vehicle Voltron and or Armored Fleet Dirigor 15, not for the podcast, but I've seen it a little bit of it before. And I can go the rest of my life without seeing any more of it.
I've seen bits of it as a child, and I don't remember anything except for a vague sense of the design of the vehicles.
Yeah, I remember having the distinct impression of like, God, that's too many parts. Like, it's too many. 15's too many. I can't keep up with all 15.
Why are you giving me a different robot?
And that was really, like, where's my lines at? Like, this ain't Voltron. So, I think that's all the questions. Did we have any questions come through email?
Not that I got.
Yeah, I didn't see any either. But you guys can email us at oldtakunoradio@antigamers.com with any, you know, questions or feedback or, you know, anything like that. You know, besides the Twitter. We're, of course, on the Twitter as well.
Where are we on the Twitter?
We are on the Twitter at Old Taco No Radio.
And where can you find our podcast other places?
Well, you can also find our podcast at antigamers.com/podcasts is where you can find all the Antigamers podcasts, including the main flagship. And they just did their much ballyhooed and anticipated episode 69 on Eroge, I think.
Yes, it is a fantastic episode. If you've yet to listen to it,
I have not, but it is in. I have downloaded it and it's in my queue. I am terrified and interested also. besides the website, you can find Old Taku No Radio on iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play, and if you want to leave us a review, we'd greatly appreciate it. We love getting the reviews, and they help other people find our show. So if you like what you hear, take a moment and give us a review. We'd greatly appreciate it.
We did get a few questions about season 2, what we'd like to see, the appearance of certain characters from Go Lion, if they'll make their way into the new series in season 2 or not. We'll cover all those questions when we finish season 2, which actually airs on January 20th, I believe.
Yes.
So that as soon as that goes up, we're definitely going to be on board for watching it. Hopefully you will be too after listening to this podcast. And yeah, we'll get to those questions then.
Woohoo!
Until then, thank you all for listening, and we will catch you next month.
Bye, guys. Probably gonna say big damn robots like 17 times. I'm just gonna warn you now because I'm just so excited to talk about something kind of just like big damn robot wrestling. You know, that's gonna be good.